And look, David, look behind. Kestrel.
Yes.
Hovering over the neighbouring field. That's cool. Off he goes.
There you go. It's a sign.
Yeah, it is a sign. It's you in the next life when you become a bird of prey.
In the UK, we live in one of the most nature-depleted regions of the world, having seen an average fall of 19% in the abundance of 753 studied terrestrial and freshwater species in the UK since 1970. Over half of all native flowering plant species have also declined during the same period. The figures don't look good. But amid the doom and gloom, we have to find some light at the end of the tunnel. As a conservation organisation, it's clear to us that just pushing out statistics about how dreadful a situation may be for any given species, or to just focus on the negatives, is not going to help us achieve our goal to conserve those species. It's arguably never been more important to get excited about nature than it is today. Finding multiple ways to communicate to different audiences about the wildlife around us is key to bringing everyone on board with the mission. Hello, I'm Tom Morath. I'm the Deputy Head of Living Collection at the Hawk Conservancy Trust, and whether it be kites or kestrels, harriers or hawks, I've a passion for birds of prey and understanding their place in the natural world. Our podcast, Nature's a Hoot, is a way to delve deeper into the world of these winged predators, to understand their natural history, their current status in the wild, and how we can support them through conservation efforts into the future. This time, I'll share my conversation with actor, artist, and fellow wildlife podcaster David Oakes, as we talk about finding time for nature, tracking golden eagles, and how arts and creativity can support conservation.
The great thing about walking around the trust with you is that the birds recognise you.
Yeah.
Every single time we've walked past an aviary, they know that you, and more in particular, your bag of food is with you.
I'm pleased you mentioned that, because it puts me in my place to know that it's really all about the...
It's all about the food.
The bag of food.
Not about you, Tom.
You might, of course, recognise that voice. If you do, and you can't quite place it, perhaps you've seen David in one of his many period roles. Vikings, Valhalla, Victoria, or the White Queen, perhaps. Or maybe you've seen him treading the boards as Mr. Darcy from Pride and Prejudice in the open air at Hyde Park, or even at Shakespeare's Globe, where his career began. Throughout all this, the common theme behind the scenes is an underlying love for wildlife and its conservation. I asked David about his experiences of wildlife and spending time here at the Trust over the years.
I grew up in and around Fordingbridge. I'm a New Forest boy, so I think the first time I came to the Conservancy was 35 years ago.
Wow.
Back in the early days. And so it's been nice sort of seeing how it's changed and grown over the years, and also coming here with my nieces and nephew, and then even bringing my own daughter here for the last few trips. Seeing certain people dressed as elves was a particular festive treat.
I wonder who that was.
Couldn't possibly mention.
No! We do all sorts here, and it's all for the good of...
We do all sorts. Understatement of the podcast there, right there. Yeah, the Christmas show was more about watching bird enthusiasts get to dress up for a change than it was about the birds.
Exactly. We're all just closet thespians, really. That's all it is.
See, I'm a thespian who's a closet bird enthusiast.
Fantastic. It's a perfect partnership. Now, listeners might be able to hear some of our flying displays going on today. We're recording in our first week of opening after being closed to the general public. So it's great for a great day for it.
Buzzard that's escaped.
It's not,
there,
I think...
It?
Waiting for it to turn. We just spotted a bird of prey flying. I think red kite.
Is it? I can't see the
tail.
Yeah,
red kite wheeling around in that sunshine. It's been so dreadful weather-wise. I think so many wild birds of prey will just be taking that opportunity to just soar. Like, you can kind of feel the thermals, can't you?
In fact, the time before last I was here, you were flying your black kites in the African display, and then all the resident red kites came over and were hovering another sort of 100 metres above them, just trying to pick up all the stuff that the black kites haven't found.
They certainly seem to be able to spot that kite shape and recognise it. You know, even though it's a different species, they definitely recognise those as kites. So you've come back over all these years. What is it that's kept you coming back here, other than being on your doorstep?
Birds of prey. I think that's the thing. Like, it's increasingly, as the years gone by, you see fewer and fewer out in the wild. So it's sort of nice to actually come and see albeit in captivity, and a great selection of birds that are being well looked after, and hopefully there are some sort of benefits to it in terms of supporting projects abroad, in Africa in particular. Yeah, it's a good organisation. It's been here long enough to keep kicking the local residents to remember that it's more than just badgers and hedgehogs and the like. Not that they're not wonderful too.
Yeah, birds of prey. We'll definitely champion birds of prey. That's sort of what we're all about, isn't it? So people will know you as kind of a star of stage and screen. They've seen you in all sorts of things.
Well, hopefully they'll
Netflix
know me. My mother knows me as a star of stage and screen, and some other people do besides.
It's a good start. And I'm sure lots of people will be listening to this, you know, because your name's sort of attached to it. And so it's great that you could be here to chat. That's a busy lifestyle. Where within that do you find, how do you find time for your love of nature? Because people might not know that you're a wildlife enthusiast as well.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, it makes it easier in some senses. I travel quite a lot for work, so I've spent a lot of time on the west coast of America filming things or looking for work over there. I spent much of the pandemic years living in Ireland, in County Wicklow, so there was a lot of Irish-focused topics in my podcast. I was out in Malaysia in the rainforest for about 3 weeks, just sort of going off roaming and filming 2 days a week, but in the rest of the time going off looking for tigers and crazy birds and insects and butterflies the size of dinner plates and all these kind of things.
And did you see tigers?
No.
No.
No, I think it's probably good that I didn't, bearing in mind it was just me and John Hannah heading off into the Malaysian rainforest without any kind of tiger protection. We saw some giant otters. That was amazing.
That's cool.
We were walking around this lake, about, I don't know, we must have been 200 miles up the coast from Kuala Lumpur. I can't remember exactly what the place was called. But yeah, there was this amazing lake, and I was like, is that a crocodile or something? I didn't really, it was too big for sort of my English knowledge to have the quick recall of what it could be.
Yeah.
Although I've proved that at a distance, I can't tell the difference between a buzzard and a red kite.
We'll let you off.
There's the sun in my eyes, the
yeah,
early spring
exactly.
Summer making me squint.
Not used to it.
But yeah, I looked closer, and then you suddenly realised that you could see these little whiskers and this domed head sticking out, and then the curve of the body and then the tail out the back. And it was a family of 4 or 5 like giant Asian otters. It was incredible.
That is cool. That is really cool. So you mentioned when we were sort of building up to meeting today that one thing that you requested whilst you were filming once was to have a golden eagle as a as a filming partner.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, I did a TV show for the BBC called The White Queen, which was set during the War of the Roses. And when I first read the script, there was a jousting sequence, and it was one of the reasons why I took the job. I'd done quite a lot of horse riding. Growing up in the New Forest, it's hard not to. And I'd got written into my contract that I'd be allowed to do all my own jousting sequences. Talk about the ego of a young actor.
Which is no mean feat, is it? Because I understand that actually actors saying they do their own stunts, that's pretty rare, isn't it?
Well, most of the time these days you're not allowed to, because
yeah.
The insurance gets scared. But when it comes to horses, I think once you've done a few shows and you haven't died, and you get to know the sort of the horse riding stunt fraternity quite well, the producers start to realise actually, no, he can ride. Like I did on the second year of the Borgias, they wrote a bareback horse riding palio race sequence for season 2, because they were like, well, he can ride and that's an exciting sequence, and if you got the camera right in front of the actor on the horse riding bareback around ancient Rome with 12 stuntmen, that looks really cool, as opposed
yeah.
to what you have to do if you can't film him. You've got to be hidden with the camera 10 metres
sure.
away with the stunt double with a bad wig and
going
hands
away from
the
you.
Size of like much larger than yours. But so I agreed to do all my own jousting for The White Queen, and then due to typical BBC budgetary slicing, they had to change the jousting sequence for a falconry sequence.
Okay.
And I was a little annoyed, and I had a little hissy fit. And I told the producer, who's a lovely woman called Gina Cronk, that that's fine. It's absolutely fine. I'm not upset at all. But I demand a golden eagle. And true to her word, she then, when we were filming in Belgium about 6 months later, turned up with this golden eagle. Which is, as you're well aware, like when you've got them on your arm, their beak is wonderfully placed at eye height.
Yeah, it's perfect, isn't it?
So you're just there going, I'm glad you don't find me a threat, because if you did, I've lost my left eye.
Or just like a tasty morsel.
Yeah, just puck. But that was incredible. And I mean, everyone loves the golden eagle. I mean, arguably as fast, if not faster, than the peregrine.
Yeah.
And it led to actually having a nice relationship with the South of Scotland Golden Eagle Project,
right?
Which Cat Barlow runs up in southern Scotland, and they are translocating young golden eagles into newer territories to try and bring their presence in the country further south. And very kindly, they asked me to name one a few months back. I mean, where was it? A year ago. I have no concept of time since becoming a parent.
What's it called?
It's called Edith the Stout.
What a great name.
Well, it was a really big female that they had. So I want to sort of... I was filming Vikings at the time and everyone was called Olaf the Great or sure. Ivan the Boneless or whatever it was. And so I was like, okay, well, we're going to give it a the something. So we call it the Stout. And Edith was the name of my character's daughter at the time, who was a wonderful, strong woman who married a Saxon king. And it was all... she was wonderful. They think that it was one of her ideas potentially to weave the Bear Tapestry and all this kind of stuff.
Wow, okay.
So Edith the Stout. It's now flying around all over the place. She was in Northern Ireland, I think, relatively recently.
And doing okay.
Yeah.
So this is a amazing. GPS.
Yeah, they've got GPS on there. One of the real perks of it, actually, is they share information of where it is with me when they shouldn't. So I get really exciting emails from Kat every now and again saying, you can't tell anyone this, but this is where Edith's been and this is how well she's doing. And
yeah,
I feel like there's a golden eagle child of mine out there being far more impressive than I could ever be.
Yeah, and of course, a fiercely defended and protected bird. They're, you know, as beautiful and majestic as they are, there's plenty of people who don't like them particularly.
Yeah.
Just because of their sheer size and power, I think. So, yeah, right to keep some of that information secretive.
I mean, quite rightly, like...
So, sort of bringing it further south then, because, you know, these days we sadly don't have golden eagles roaming around, flying around in the Hampshire and Wiltshire countryside.
Not yet.
Not yet.
New Forest ponies.
Yeah. Yeah, that's for another day. When you're out in the countryside close to home, what is there anything you kind of go looking for? Anything that you sort of hope to see when you're out and about?
There's a... when the drive to my daughter's nursery goes past a tree that has a buzzard roost in it. So we always slow down when we go past the buzzard tree to have a look out the window, which
Great.
She absolutely adores. To have a three-year-old that can recognise birds of prey is a real perk. That and dinosaurs. She's got her dinosaur ID.
Same thing, right? Same difference.
Same thing. There's no
birds
difference. Birds of prey, dinosaur, everything, all the same. But yeah, there's a few sites around me where I deliberately look. But, I mean, I see a lot more kestrels than I used to see, which makes
That's
me
good.
Really happy because... I mean, growing up as a kid in the 80s, they were everywhere, and now they're not. I think they were the most populous bird of prey in the 80s, and
now
buzzards taken over. But yeah, kites everywhere. Buzzards, not bad. Kestrels, improving. But it's when you see a sparrowhawk or something that you don't expect to see that you go, well, that's brilliant.
That little spark of excitement,
isn't
it? Yeah.
But where I live in Somerset, there's so much agriculture. There's so many fields. So the hope of anything being able to find a place to live is really hard. There's some tawnies near us that you can hear of an evening. That's amazing. We go outside and listen to those just talk to each other across the way, and that's wonderful.
Great. In fact, funny you should mention that, because if you'd like to, I'd like to give you an opportunity to come and meet one of our resident tawny owls.
Let's do it. Let's go see a tawny.
Let's have a wander up that way to the woodland and see what she's got to say.
As we chatted on our way to meet the resident birds here at the Trust, I wanted to ask David more about his podcast, Trees a Crowd. Like Nature's a Hoot, David's podcast is dedicated to the natural world as he talks to people who make their life's work to protect it.
So you clearly use the platform you have and that ability to move around the world as a result of the work that you do.
Mm-hmm.
How important do you think it is to keep sort of wildlife and the natural world in the general conversation?
I think there's nothing more important than to keep people talking about the environment. I think actually at the moment we're at danger of it being taken for granted again, in the sense that everyone knows about climate change now, everyone knows about habitat destruction, at least in the first world. And so people are unimpressed by it, and we're sort of going back now to a point where we need to be more sensationalist again to try and grab the headlines in the way that certainly pre-pandemic we were sort of actually making some headway. And I think certainly the pandemic has sort of refocused people's attentions away from conservation and environmental concerns, because concerns became closer to hand. They affected your bank balance and your health and your loved ones much more directly than the, in 20 years we could have this going wrong, and if we lose that species then that could go. And I think it's really important to keep it alive. I think, as I said, in the first world we're getting back to that point where it's becoming commonplace, but it's about the privilege of having nature in our life again. The privilege of being able to think about rewilding is a huge one when you look on a global scale. And I think one of the things that does get my goat a bit at the moment are private, wealthy rewilding initiatives, which is great for habitat preservation and creating green links that things can travel along. But it's, nature shouldn't be something that only the wealthy can maintain, because if it does, you end up with a class war all over again, and that's never going to be good for things. When I finish here today, I've got a Zoom talk with part of the Woodland Trust about their youth initiatives, and I think that's the thing. Like, with that organisation, there's a lot of older generations that are keen in preserving woodlands, and there are people even sort of buy an acre here, buy an acre there of ancient woodland to do their bit, which they then fence off and let no one see apart from themselves, which is wonderful in part, but also not another part. But so I'm trying to have a chat with them to see how we can nurture a sort of a younger generation to care about trees. It's quite easy to get young people to care about dynamic things, but to get them to care about an ancient woodland is slightly trickier.
Mm. So if you spoke to lots of really interesting people as part of your podcast, have you got any favourites, or have they each individually been exciting?
You can't have favourites. They might listen to this.
Of course you can.
There's been some brilliant conversations. Normally they're the ones that go in a direction that I wasn't expecting. There was, back in season one, this is a sort of a preamble to the story. I used to live in Crystal Palace and became a bit obsessed with the World Fair that happened there, because what happened at that point was they also built those dinosaurs down at the bottom of the park, which are Victorian anatomically incorrect
perfect at the time,
but absolutely they thought the ammonite was an eye. Like, that was the scientific thinking at the time. It was, I mean, not to patronise them, but pretty basic. But it was like the most accurate scientific information. Anyway, I became obsessed with World Fairs. And so, in a break between jobs, I went out to Milan with a friend, because it turned out the World Fairs still happen. Not that anybody really knows, but they do. And I went out to Milan to the World Expo of whenever it was, and the British tent, or a thing, was made by a man called Wolfgang Buttress, and it was this sort of giant cube that you could walk up into, which had a light and sound display that was made from microphones that were in a beehive in Bedfordshire, and then transmitted through the internet, and then affected this world that you're in. It was all about feeding the world, and the importance of bees and biodiversity and interconnectedness, all that kind of stuff. And it was brilliant. Since then, they've moved that to Kew Gardens, so you can go and see this amazing installation. And it's brilliant. Anyway, so Wolfgang was one of the first people on my list that I wanted to talk to, and I got in touch with him, and he said, "Great, yeah, love the chat. Would you like to talk to the physicist that I made it with too?" And I was like, can't really say no, because that means I don't get to talk to Wolfgang, and everyone should talk to a man called Wolfgang at one point in their life. So I said, yes, I'll talk to your colleague Martin as well, the Hungarian physicist, and I'll try and make a physicist sort of blend into the natural world conversation in some form. Now, it turned out that Martin is the single most interesting human being I've ever met in my entire
life.
Really? Yeah. And the podcast is well worth listening to for Wolfgang, but even more so for Martin, who's just this beautiful, beautiful eccentric who once filled his wife's cello full of bees to see what the resonant quality of the bees
I read that on your page,
It's just those leaps of creative imagination that he as a scientist was making to see what was going on was like fundamental, I think, to me trying to sort of extend the podcast into looking at how artists and scientists can collaborate and intermerge and come up with the most amazing human endeavours. So he's one of my all-time favourites.
Yeah, love that. It's like you were saying earlier on, you've got to have that creativity and the arts coming into the conversation with anything science-based if you want it to be, I guess, digestible, accessible to a wide spectrum of people.
It's one of the reasons why I very proudly I'm an ambassador for the David Sheppard Wildlife Foundation, who are championing conservation efforts across the world, but primarily using art as a way to do it. So they run the Wildlife Artist of the Year competition and get people to paint and draw and maquillage and sculpt and whatever pieces of wildlife, and it champions creativity with conservation being the end goal. But the thing that I find particularly interesting is that weird point in the middle where they merge, where an artist isn't simply an artist, but they're a conservationist hero. And then the weirder directions that they tend to go in is where I find the fascination much more acutely.
Now, it was time for David to meet some of the birds who call the Hawk Conservancy Trust home. I first introduced him to a few of our native species of owls.
Let's head out this way. I just want to pop round the corner. We'll go and see a couple of the owls that live round here, because this section here has almost become like our little British owl area. Mm-hmm. Going along with that idea of a bit of creativity alongside the science of what we're trying to push. So we sort of developed these almost like old cottages where birds of prey may have found a home, where they can't find, you know, an odd hollow in a tree, sure, something like that.
They look like sort of opportunity. Haciendas,
yeah, they sort of do, don't they? So we've got, obviously got five native species of owl here in the UK, uh-huh, the short-eared owl and the little owl. We've got the long-eared owl here, Teddy.
Teddy.
Yeah.
Hey, Teddy.
Have you seen long-eared owls?
Not in the wild. Not in the wild. I'd much rather know they were there than see that they're there, mm, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's a nice ethos to have. I always find anything that you try and go looking for is usually the only thing you don't see.
Oh, yeah,
you
never see it. I did a thing for the Manta Trust recently, and me and my partner went out, and she's a keen diver like I am. And we'd gone out and seen a lot of manta rays over this time, and one of the scientists out there from the Trust was like, do you want to come out for a snorkel this afternoon? And Nat was like, oh, no, I'm going to stay in tonight, I've got some work to do. So I was like, well, you don't mind me just going off for a snorkel. And of course, that was the one dive where three giant whale sharks,
no,
come along, and Nat's never seen a whale shark. She hasn't quite forgiven me. I didn't tell her at first, and then the scientist...
Through fear? Or...
when she found... I don't know whether I got in more trouble for seeing the whale sharks or for hiding the fact that I'd seen them. But they're amazing, amazing species. And ones that I'd seen before, actually, as well, so... No, I wasn't happy with it.
No, I can imagine. So next door to the long-eared owl, we've got the tawny, which we spoke about a little, mm-hmm, earlier on. Had the rest of her lunch.
That still kind chatting.
Of classic Tuwhitu call. Just about here, Sage, given the first part of that call. Mm-hmm. At night, she'll hoot as well.
It must sound amazing at night here.
Yeah.
You do night visits, right?
We do, yeah. Yeah, and actually you can come and see the owls flying at night, which is kind of special because you enter their world.
And who's this barn owl next door?
Yeah, we've got Charlie the barn owl.
Hey, Charlie. They're so elegant, aren't they?
You can see why people, historically, you know, they would have thought that bird was a ghost.
Yeah.
So, you know, just a white figure, got that silent glide.
They were one of the first animals that I learned how to draw.
Okay.
The sort of combination of the eye proximity to the, it's not the nose, but that sort of the shading that they have,
sure,
down that leads down to the beak, like that perfect sort of dipped triangle from the eyes, is the easiest way to start drawing, mm, any bird of prey, as far as I understand it.
And you still draw birds?
Yeah.
Still paint birds?
Yeah, it used to be what I did when I wasn't making a podcast. I did quite a lot of artistry. But now that I'm a father, there's no time for hobbies.
No. Unless you want to hand over the paintbrush. And...
Well, that is fun, actually. We watched a bit of Dumbo the other day and started drawing elephants and crows. That's an animal that I think is far too maligned as the crow and any corvid. The corvids are just an astounding group of birds.
The raven is like... Oh. I call it my guilty pleasure because obviously I'm supposed to be all birds of prey, mm-hmm, but the raven's my favourite bird.
Just amazing. And the return of the chough is like, it's,
yeah,
just amazing.
It's really
in this
cool
country. Like, well, at least the support and the prevalence with which they're coming back.
Mm. Just like these birds, actually. We're just next door here to the white storks, which, mm, you know, absent from the British countryside for, I think, 600 years until a few years ago. And you know, thanks to like a rewilding project, mm-hmm, and through people kind of coming together and work together, they're back again. So. Yeah.
Do you find people stop and look at the storks?
Yeah.
Or do they like, look, barn owl, mum,
yeah,
barn owl?
I don't know.
Storks,
I think because they're
hey
so
guys
big and white,
yeah,
they stand out. I'm not sure everybody always knows what they are at first glance. Mm-hmm. And obviously a sort of slight stray from what is our, you know, regular theme of birds of prey. But of course they're sort of reliant on the same sort of habitats and,
yeah,
you know, the same food chain.
They're savannah birds, really, aren't they?
Yeah, or sort of massively migratory. So here in the UK, they're sort of wetland birds, open meadows,
sure,
water meadows, and then migrate, like you say, south of the Sahara, ready for a warmer winter.
Having a nice groom there. You've got a nice job, haven't you?
Lovely job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Vultures are great.
Yes.
Just.
Yeah, they're so often. I guess, underrepresented at best, and sort of painted in a not the best light.
Yeah. It's that weird thing with the Jungle Book, is they turn up as quite nice animals, but very quickly forgot that one.
So we're just next to one of our large aviaries here. This is two African white-backed vultures and a white-headed vulture in front.
Yeah.
So all birds that have hatched out here at one point or another.
And of course, I had to ask David our recurring question.
So we always ask this to anyone who comes along on the podcast, and that is, if you could be a bird of prey...
Yes, I would.
Which would which species?
Oh, it's got to be the kestrel. It's got to be the kestrel. Like, Falco tenunculus. All day, all night, just adaptable, charming, bright, not too many predators, varied diet, can just hover and look, just head up there and just sit for a bit and just... And their plumage, they're beautiful. Just that... That orange tone with the browns, and they're perfect little birds. Mm. And I mean, in the greater family of kestrels, as you look at the species across the world, like, you'll find a kestrel pretty much everywhere you go. And they're just wonderful. Just wonderful.
And as luck would have it, as we ended our time together, what did we spot high above the neighbouring field? But
look, David, look behind. Kestrel.
Yes.
Hovering over the neighbouring field. That's cool. Off he goes.
There you go. It's a sign.
Yeah, it is a sign. It's you in the next life when you become a bird of prey. Well, thank you, David, for spending some time with us today.
Pleasure.
It's been really nice to chat, and it's nice to know that we share a lot of the sort of rationale behind what we do. You know, talking to people about the natural world and inspiring people in different ways, rather than just reading a book or watching a documentary. You know,
it's nice to be here during half term and seeing all the kids walking around and sort of going, well, what journeys are starting today that are going to take them for the rest of their lives?
Yeah, because I mean, certainly if you came here as a youngster and I, you know, saw birds of prey as a youngster too, that was sort of us. Yeah, however many years ago, more years ago than we'd like to say.
Hooked by the talent.
I like that. We said no sound bites.
Sorry. I'll go home now.
Whether it be talking to listeners through the podcasts we host, or talking to them face to face, it was clear that David and I shared the belief that it takes more than just facts and figures to inspire an audience. A creative approach is key. I get the sense that we need more ideas than ever if we're to turn the tide on the fortunes of our beloved birds of prey. So many of them are now facing odds that are stacked against them. Through our conservation research work at the Hawk Conservancy Trust, we promise to do just that. To keep trying, even in the face of terrible odds. To think outside the box and do all we can to conserve birds of prey and their habitats. It was great fun chatting to David, and I'd like to take the opportunity to thank him for his time and support in putting this episode together. I get the sense that this won't be the last time that our paths cross here at the Trust. Tree to Crowd, just like Nature's a Hoot, can be found on all major podcast hosting platforms. If you've been inspired to visit the Trust for yourself, you can find us near Andover, just off the A303 in Hampshire in the UK. Details about visiting and the work we do can be found online, hawk-conservancy.org. Loads more bird of prey content can also be found on our social media pages. Find us on Facebook, X, Instagram, and TikTok. If you've enjoyed this episode, which I hope you have, please subscribe and perhaps even consider leaving us a review wherever you get your podcasts.